British writer Ian McEwan's new novel, Enduring Love, begins with a crisis that acts like a domino, engendering a series of moral dilemmas for the main character, Joe. Picture this. You and your wife are having a picnic out in the countryside. Your wife is just passing you a bottle of wine when you hear a shout. You jump to your feet. You start running in the direction of the shout. You know it's an emergency, and you see other men running towards this emergency, too. Here's Ian McEwan reading from the beginning of Enduring Love.
What were we running towards? I don't think any of us would ever know fully. But superficially, the answer was a balloon. Not the nominal space that encloses a cartoon character's speech or thought, or, by analogy, the kind that's driven by mere hot air. It was an enormous balloon filled with helium, that elemental gas forged from hydrogen in the nuclear furnace of the stars, first step along the way in the generation of multiplicity and variety of matter in the universe, including ourselves and all our thoughts. We were running towards a catastrophe, which itself was a kind of furnace in whose heat identities and fates would buckle into new shapes. At the base of the balloon was a basket in which there was a boy, and by the basket, clinging to a rope, was a man in need of help.
Your main character, Joe, goes to aid a man and a young boy who's caught in the basket of the helium balloon as it seems to be being blown away by gusts of high winds. And, of course, what eventually happens is that four men converge on this balloon, on the basket, hold on to ropes, and as the winds rise, one of them lets go, and the basket is lifted up into the air. And at that point, the remaining men, except for one, let go of the ropes. The balloon with its basket lifts off the ground with one man hanging onto a rope. And that man hangs on until he eventually falls to his death. And the other characters, the other men, of course, watch this happen. Now, the main character that you write about is this supremely rational human being. He's a former scientist, a science writer, and he seems so ill-equipped to deal with all of the moral dilemmas and moral questions that arise out of this incident. For instance, was it wrong to let go? Was it wrong if letting go was an act of self-preservation? Was it wrong for him to let go if one person let go first? These things start to cycle in his brain. Was this the dilemma you posed to yourself when you sat down to write how a rational mind goes about making sense of moral ambiguities?
Yes, and actually, I have to disagree with you a little there, because the novel is really built around the premise that perhaps there's a little more to be said for rationality than we often are prepared to accept, and that perhaps there are moral dilemmas to which we should bring some rationality rather than just, a welter of feeling. And I wanted to sort of write a novel in which we might see a rather calm, organized, sensible chap like Joe finding his life torn apart by a complete whirlwind of an eruption of unreason into his life in the form of another man who becomes obsessed by him. And I wanted to see if there wasn't ways in which, in fact, rationality has its strengths. And remember that as they're hanging there above the ground with this terrible thing happening, trying to hold this balloon down, knowing that if they all hang on there together, they'll keep the balloon weighted on the ground. If one of them lets go, then they'll all have to let go. That it's Joe who's able to actually articulate, partly through his understanding of science, something of the background to that dilemma, our selfishness against our altruism, the fact that we have within us these rather contradictory impulses towards other people. We want to help them, but we also want to save our own skins. So Joe is, in a sense, quite well placed to bring us that dilemma and experience it for himself.
Before you wrote the book, did you have an answer of what you would have done if you had been there? I mean, did you have to have an answer for that to write?
I think it's impossible to know. I mean, I'd like to think I'd do the right thing, but the right thing can sometimes be suicidal. In other words, we can behave well when we're in a situation where behaving well makes sense, if you see what I mean. As long as they're cooperating, those fellows hanging onto the rope, they are, in a sense, as Joe puts it, a good society. Once one of them breaks ranks and the balloon is going up higher and you know that you're not going to be able to hang on and your options are narrowing, then you better start behaving selfishly rather than throw your life away for nothing. And that calculation is very difficult to make. It has to be made in a split second. And I think that people tend to make it on the basis of pure character alone. You know, there's hardly time to make a calculation as such. You sort of feel your way into it. Key moments in a person's life in which they're called on to respond in ways that actually surprise them and perhaps even change them for the rest of their lives.
It's interesting how you describe that moment. You write that the moment Joe felt the balloon lurch upwards after someone let go, the matter was settled for him. Altruism had no place. Being good made no sense. Do you find people lose this veneer of civilization that quickly in a moment?
Well, I think they do. And I don't really think of it as a veneer. I think there are situations, for example, I think war is one, civil war, when all the ordinary rules of everyday life break down. And then you'll find quite ordinary people behaving perhaps with great cruelty and surprising themselves with their own ferocity. We're held in check, you know, by living together, by cooperating, and by, you know, accepting that we can't satisfy every selfish impulse we have. And yet at the same time, we can't be completely selfless. You know, we can't be completely altruistic. We do have to stick up for ourselves. And that push and pull really does underpin, I think, much of what we do call morality. But certainly, when all the rules have collapsed, when no one is obeying any of the rules, then you might be a fool to obey them yourself.
Now, one of the other men who held onto a rope before letting go, and his name is Jed, he develops a romantic obsession with this main character, Joe, and he stalks him, one of his intentions being to convert him to Christianity. What interested you in setting up this situation, this complication?
Well, Jed Parry is suffering. We don't know this at the beginning of the book, but by the end we certainly do. He's suffering from a rather rare psychological syndrome known as de Clairembeau syndrome. It's a peculiar state of mind. It involves becoming completely convinced that a certain person has fallen in love with you and you are obliged to return that love. It's a completely delusionary state. It requires no evidence. Often people who suffer from it feel that the loved one, the person they are obsessing about, is sending them messages. Even if the loved one is calling the police or bringing the courts down on you or getting court orders or screaming at you to go away, in your psychotic delusional state, you will reinterpret this in some other way. You'll see it as a form of encouragement. So I don't think, when I came across this state of mind, I thought, I don't think I've ever read of anything more unreasonable than this state. And I can't think of anything quite so frightening or challenging for someone's grip on rationality than to become the object of obsession for such a person, because nothing you say or do would convince them to go away. The other thing that struck me about it was that the object of obsession becomes somewhat obsessed himself or herself. If every time you step outside of your apartment, there's the same person waiting there, if they're phoning you 30 times a day or turning up unexpectedly at your workplace, you begin to obsess about them. You know, you're always expecting them around every corner, and you become something of a monomaniac too. You get dragged, as it were, into the madness.
I'm speaking with British writer Ian McEwan. His new novel is Enduring Love. You grew up abroad in Singapore, I believe, and North Africa. Your father was he was in the British military.
Yeah, I'm an army brat, and we traveled around first in, as you say, in Singapore. But the really memorable time for me was in Tripoli, in Libya, in North Africa. When the American Air Force bombed Tripoli, I was amazed to see that the place where Gaddafi was hiding out was my old school, where I went when I was 8 years old. I recognized it so clearly. And I've always wanted to go back. I'd love to go back to Libya, but it hasn't been safe, obviously, for a number of years.
Growing up an outsider, do you think that turned you into an observer, a writer?
I've often thought about this. I mean, in some ways, I think it did. I certainly wasn't an outsider in any grand existential sense, but my father was promoted from the ranks to become an officer sometime in the 50s when I was growing up, and we were immediately sent on to another kind of base and had a complete change of friends. And he occupied a sort of curious space, as those officers do, not quite accepted by, you know, the middle class, officer class, people who went to the, high-flying academies. But having left behind the sergeants and the corporals, who were once his colleagues. Then I went to a boarding school, which was a very sort of set-apart place, way out in the countryside, filled mostly with very bright but pretty rough kids from central London who'd come from families who'd broken up. And then I went to a very brand-new university, so that by the time I was 20 or so and wanting to start writing fiction, I wasn't able to place myself in the way that most English writers can. A lot of English writing, I don't know if you are aware of this, traditionally has been very involved with class and status and the little sort of problems of when you rise in your class or fall in it. I had no idea where I stood in all that. And I was completely ignorant, really, of my own position or really of how other people lived. And that's what rather impelled me to write these rather strange and gothic tales of, that were considered extremely perverse when they came out. In fact, they're still considered extremely perverse, and I'm still castigated for them. I think it did have something to do with my upbringing.
It sounds very liberating, though.
It was, actually. It was, people used to accuse me of writing to shock, and I used to deny it vehemently, but I'm beginning to think that maybe there was an element of that I did want to just burst out and write in a way that was not just vivid, but over-vivid. It was writing that was almost like super real for painting. I don't write like that anymore. I mean, I certainly don't write short stories like that anymore. But it did... Yes, it did sort of uncork me. It did set me in motion like a kind of large watch. I've been ticking ever since, I hope.
Some of your first novels and your stories, many of them were about children or from a child's point of view. And I'm thinking that you grew up in pretty vivid circumstances. And that when I read a lot of your work, it sounds as if you can really call up childhood, the experience of being a child, if not your actual experiences, the impressions of childhood so vividly and so quickly. Are they right there in your arsenal for you, fresh when you need them?
Well, you know, I invented a lot of childhood for myself in my fiction. Although, obviously, I drew on all the emotional colors of my own memory. I don't know why it is. I've got something of a prejudice against reading books by writers about their sensitive childhoods. And I always say to myself, no, don't tell us about your childhood. Invent one for us. that we can all inhabit. And that was rather my own view of making up children and childhoods in my early fiction. I've never been much interested in writing about my own. I don't know why. So it, something about facts I find oppressive in when I'm writing fiction. I'd rather invent than remember.
Ian McEwan, it's been a real pleasure talking with you today. Thank you.
Thank you.
Ian McEwan's new novel is Enduring Love.